morning.
The committee will come to order. We're, it's Wednesday, January 16th, 2006, 9:10 a.m. This is the House Ways and Means Committee. President and Representative Seaton and Representative Gruenberg and myself, Representative Wyrock. We are going to take continuing public testimony on House Bill 223, the Natural Gas Pipeline Incentive Gas Tax Act, or bill. And where we had left it last week was Mark Myers was testifying telephonically. And Mr. Myers, are you online?
Mr. Chairman, I am.
Okay, why don't we continue with your testimony, sir? And if you will give us your name, your lack of affiliation, and your continue with your testimony, we'll see if the committee has any questions, and then we'll go to further telephonic testimony and testimony from folks here in Juneau. Mr. Myers?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Mark Myers. I'm the former director of the Division of Oil and Gas within DNR.
You can.
I am just representing myself here, and basically I'm here to answer questions. I just maybe to summarize what I had presented at the last meeting. Basically, I went through the economics of the project as explained by Econ 1, and in summary, the economics of the project at prices north of $3 is very robust. The project is actually net positive at prices below $3 per MMBTU. So in today's price world, where we're looking at today's prices of around $9 and projected future prices, certainly greater than $5 by everyone's, pretty much everyone's forecast long term. The project has very, very positive economics. The pipeline economics itself are dominantly paid for by the regulated return that's given on the invested capital. So the question is, in the upstream, is the rate of return on this project sufficient to entice investors to invest in it? And the Econ 1 numbers go through a number of scenarios at various prices, various price overruns. You use a $4, $5, and $6 price deck to show the various returns. And in all cases, all their analysis showed at $4, $5, and $6 that the project was very robust, both from a pipeline, integrated pipeline owner upstream perspective, from a upstream perspective only, or from a perspective where say, the upstream investors would own about half of the pipeline. So the conclusion they came to, which is a very similar to the analysis performed by the state previously, mirrors that, again, at expected prices, and those prices, again, are expected by most people to be considerably north of $5 long-term, and recent purchases like ConocoPhillips' purchase of Burlington Resources indicated a $7 to $8 long-term price forecast, at least by Conoco, in that particular $34 billion investment. So when we look at it, the industry believes, I think it believes in strong prices, certainly north of the $3 or $4 kind of stress prices that were used to analyze this project. And under those assumptions, even with high cost overruns on the project, it still is a very lucrative project with investment returns that are very typical of those expected for a petroleum company investment. And then with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mark, we're looking at this at the bill here, the HB 223, as a basically an incentive tax. And I'm wondering, have you looked at that bill as well as and analyzed it? I guess what I'm curious about is the I don't see any reference to interest being accumulated and paid back under this act, or there's no loss, doesn't seem to be a loss after commitment, but before you get around to shipping gas. Does this need some more incentive in this? I mean, I don't think we want people using this is just a bank and say, okay, we can put the money in and it'll earn interest and we'll get everything back if we delay shipping as long as it's within the time frame. Can you give me your take on those factors in the analysis we're doing here?
Representative Seaton to the chair. I'm certainly not an expert on this bill, and I really didn't come to testify in support of a reserves tax, but merely to explain I believe the project in itself at expected gas prices is highly economic. But and so you'd really have to talk to the authors and sponsors of the bill to understand the motivation. But my understanding is generally the design of the tax is not designed to be damaging to the companies. It's designed to get a project jump-started and going. And there's, I think, a recognition in that project that we're not trying to be, the state is not trying to be punitive, but just trying to make sure the project moves forward. And then if it does make sure, if the project does move forward on a timely basis, then the companies recover all the tax loss there. So I think the intent, the way I read the bill, and again, it would be better to talk to the bill sponsors on this, is not to be punitive or not to be overreaching, but to really provide an incentive to build the project in a timely manner, again, based on the assumption, I believe, that the project is economics as a number show.
Okay, and is your, if I may follow up, Mr. Chairman, is your feeling that a deposit of money with the state and then receiving that money back is enough of an incentive to aid in stimulating the development of a gas pipeline?
I represent the state to the chair. It really depends, again, on the legislature's view of the economics of the project. If they believe, as I do, that the economics of this project are robust and it needs to move forward, then the net effect of that is just some additional encouragement to move it forward. However, if they believe that the project is uneconomic, you shouldn't do this in the first place. So that's the one extreme. The other extreme is, does the state want to come off as punitive or, you know, put great costs to the companies should they not be able to complete in a timely manner in spite of good efforts? So I believe the bill authors, again, you need to speak to them, but I believe when I read it, there's an intent here to cut a middle ground somewhere in between not being too punitive, but making sure the state's made relatively whole if the project doesn't move forward. I think also, when you look at a reserves tax, one of the things you don't want to discourage is future exploration. So it needs to be structured in a way that the independent explorers or the producers, when they look for new gas and find it, those that don't control the pipeline or time in the pipeline aren't penalized by that. And I think there's some ways within the bill that was, I believe, attempted to look at. Again, you need to really get down to the depths with the bill sponsors to really answer their intent. But the way I read some of that language is they were trying to not affect future exploration as well or create a disincentive for exploration in there, and therefore they were concerned about the characteristics of that gas that would be considered economic but not produced today.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
And an additional question. I've been looking at the bill on page 2 here. It says gas is not taxable under this chapter. This is on, if you have the bill on line 10, 11 through 15, there is not taxable under this chapter if the gas is not subject to a state-approved oil and gas unit. Now, does that mean, in your reading of this, does that mean if it hasn't been unitized, then it's not taxable? And how common is it for us to have large gas reserves that are not unitized?
Representative Seaton to the chair, and I apologize, I don't have the bill sitting right in front of me, but basically, I think, again, intent-wise there was once it's unitized, generally unitization doesn't occur until the leases are at the very end of their primary term. So typically in the foothills, for example, it would be closer to 10 years from the initial issuance of the lease. So in those cases, unitization occurs in one of two conditions. One is the companies want to keep the leases and they want to have a firm commitment for exploration, or in the more common or typical approach that they're ready to develop the field in order to hold the leases, in order to produce the property in common. And you may have different lease owners. You unitize and do a common unit to maximize the relative rights of all parties, to see minimization of physical and economic waste, and also to hold the leases. It also then allows you to get to a common equity, but those processes typically occur after the resources are discovered. So I think I would guess again, and you have to talk to the bill authors about the intent, but that language tells you that if you're an explorer out there and you've bought the leases and you're in your primary term of the leases, then you're not subject to this tax unless you choose to unitize in a very early part of the primary term of the lease, and that very rarely happens. So basically, I think this is designed to be an encouragement toward exploration.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions of Mr. Myers? Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Myers. Is there anyone else here in the audience that wanted to testify on the bill? There's a number of people who are available to ask, answer questions if the committee has any questions of Mr. Hurley from ConocoPhillips, or the Department of Revenue, or the Office of Management and Budget. If not, if the sponsor could come forward for a minute. Do you want to address any of Representative Seaton's questions, Representative Croft?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman Wyrock, Representative Seaton. Representative Seaton, I like the way you think. The drafting versions of this bill and working with former Governor Hickle, there was somewhat of a he wanted me to increase the incentive. He wanted to push it farther. The two specific questions you had on not in impacting future exploration. You're exactly right. The language on page 2, lines 10 through 18, the gas that is not taxable under this chapter, we excluded units, which is former Director Myers was talking about, are older established fields, and particularly Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson. And then these lease or any lease, in effect, would have to be over 10 years old. And nothing is affected, no future exploration, no future finds are affected by this bill. Go out and find the biggest gas field in the world, in North America. Go out and find what you will. It will not be subject to this tax. This is an incentive for companies that have been sitting on gas for decades to develop it. And we specifically crafted it so that it would not affect any future exploration. That's a very important part of the bill. Second, the structure of the credit, and that's principally on page 6, most of page 6, but lines 7 through 25, saying where a credit may not be allowed. And to address your question, sort of assuming this is a good idea, is it enough of an incentive to get Exxon and British Petroleum to move on this project?
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Page 6?
Could you tell us which page and line you were on.
Yeah.
Just for the record, we're joined by Representative Moses and Representative Roper.
On page 6, at the end of the section on the credit, and it's lines 7 through 25, it lists a number of things that the credit cannot be used for. So it can only be used for up to 50% of the tax. That is the severance tax owed each month. So I can't write off my whole tax in a year, only half of it. The modeling that we had done in drafting the bill, and then on lines 22 and 23, the credit ends in 2030. So I'm perfectly willing to discuss, open to the idea of having some sort of additional incentive incorporated in the bill. But let's recognize the middle ground that Mark Myers was talking about that we were trying to do. We were trying to have a price for warehousing Alaska's gas that was not overly punitive, that had some rational relationship to the revenues we would lose by not having this gas project, but enough of an incentive to move these companies forward. Because the credit does not give any credit for interest, that is, they pay $1 billion and they get $1 billion back at some later date, you lose the time value of money. So paying, I would be glad for any member of this committee or anyone in the listening audience, if they will pay me $100 for the next 7 years, I'll then pay them $50 a year until that's paid off afterwards. That will make me money. That will be fine. The time value of money and the interest has an incentive in it. In addition, because the we asked in the modeling, tell me when the credit would need to end so that they would get all their money back if they, without interest, but get all their money back if they acted promptly. So under certain assumptions, here we are in 2005, 6, takes 6 to 7 years to get it built. Say they paid the tax till 2013 and then had 17 years of getting the credit. That is about the break-even point, 2013-14. So you can say to Exxon and British Petroleum, if you start now diligently and do what you need to do, you will get all the money back without interest, but get all the money back. But every year of delay on this project, that credit drops off that 2030 cliff, and less of it do you get back until 3 or 4 years of delay. They're not getting much back of it at all because of the way interest works. So I do think there's an incentive here, though I'm perfectly willing to discuss ideas. You and I have discussed some of, should you make the credit reduce over time to provide an additional incentive. Governor Hickel was adamant that the amount of the tax be raised from 2 cents per MCF to 3. The original bill that I'd introduced had about raised about $650 million a year. Do those answer your questions?
Mr. Chairman, the other thing that I didn't find in here, where does it specifically say so that we're not talking about a, you know, court action later to determine this, that interest is not accrued, or that they're not available to get the interest that accrues on the money that's deposited?
Well, because the credit section deals only with a one-to-one credit for tax paid. We considered, had drafted, and did not include a section that also gave them credit for interest. So I think by not having it, by its absence, is why we know that it's a one-to-one. You get a dollar you paid in 2007, you get that dollar deducted in 2014, and we made no provision for it. We could make it clearer if you would like. I believe if you wanted interest to be added and then deductible on a credit, you'd have to say so.
Representative Grunberg.
Having litigated the issue of interest up to the Alaska Supreme Court in a different kind of a case, I think we'd be much safer in specifically stating no interest.
I have a lot of interest in doing that, then.
Yeah. Can I ask another question, Mr.
Chairman? Representative Grunberg.
Is there any value to the petroleum company in having a lease that doesn't produce in any value except denying that lease to a competitor? For example, does it help the company's balance sheet for creditworthiness and stuff like that? What are the benefits to the company in having a non-producing lease?
A number, and it's an excellent question, and I think it's the fundamental question that we as owners need to confront. Why? Because the fundamental idea of a lease is that we're going to put ourselves in the same situation so our interests align, and that the oil companies will have every interest to develop it for their profit motive that will benefit us, and we who do not have the expertise in oil and gas will let them handle the business affairs. That equation breaks down when our interests start to diverge, when there are significant reasons why Exxon and British Petroleum might want to reserve the gas, even though it was perfectly economic to produce. The three major ones, I believe, are a lot of an oil company's stock price is based on its reserves. One of the challenges in the consolidation of the oil industry over the last 10 years is as these companies get bigger and bigger, and particularly Exxon, and you're producing more and more, and that's great for your bottom line, you put pressure on your reserves, and Wall Street wants to see that you have adequate reserves to keep up the pace and growth. I don't want to be Exxon's reserves. And part of this bill is we are not going to be the warehouse to keep a stock price up. You mentioned competition, and it's absolutely correct. I think it's not that somehow ConocoPhillips is looking out for our interest and Exxon is not, that there's mean people on one side and good people on the other. The reason I think that ConocoPhillips is more interested in this project than Exxon or British Petroleum is they have much more of their reserves here. The more, and Exxon has a tremendous amount in other parts of the world where they're, where those entities, those nations, are putting tremendous pressure on them to develop it. It's sort of a, it's competitive in two ways. We're competitive to see how tough are we going to be about developing our resources. And if Indonesia is better at saying, oh, no, you will develop this gas field, and Russia and the Middle East, and we, and our attitude is do it whenever it's convenient for you, we will just quite naturally be put at the back of the bus. So interests, you asked what the second interest I'd identify that Exxon would have is, they're getting tremendous pressure from other nations and very little from us up to date. And the final one is competition in the ordinary sense. That is, the more interested ConocoPhillips gets, maybe the less interested Exxon does. The more they know that putting this development off 2 or 3 years hurts certain smaller players for us, the independents, Anadarko, but more importantly, some of the smaller players from our perspective, still very huge on the global scale, of ConocoPhillips, who wants, I believe, has an interest in developing it, the more they get, they're getting a competitive advantage. So it's reserves are nice, competition around the world to develop, and if we're not doing it, maybe we get put at the back of the bus, and they get to squeeze some of their own competitors at the same time. You put all those together, there start to be significant reasons why an Exxon or a British Petroleum would decide, even though it makes money, let's just not do it for a decade.
Mr. Chatoud,
yeah, sure.
Are you aware of whether anybody else, you know, you've just sort of put a tax on this. Is there any way of quantifying the value of the interests you've just expressed directly quantifying those interests for the purpose of establishing the rate of the tax?
Well, very interesting question as well. You could base this tax on a number of things. What would it take to overcome the obstacles within Exxon and British Petroleum? That was, what would it take to change their mind? Or you could take it on the basis of what kind of revenues is the state of Alaska losing by delay? A harm to us, if you will, or a lost profit to them? I think both of those numbers would be substantially higher than $1 billion a year. And it's the reason that while I listened to my young friend, Governor Hickel, to the point where I increased it some, I did not want to put it at the actual value of what we would lose, which I think is more in the $4 to $5 billion range. Certainly at $9 and $7 prices of gas, we are losing a tremendous amount of money every year it's not developed. And it's very hard to quantify the advantages to Exxon of having those reserves and squeezing their competitors and not having to produce, not having the same pressures that everywhere else on the globe is exerting placed here. To have a safe place to warehouse gas, maybe developing a project nice in Visa's terms, a safe place to warehouse your gas may be priceless.
Are you aware of any economists or any economic model that has been developed to actually directly quantify those kinds of things?
We have good economic modeling that shows how much the state would make from this project. And that's on any models, any of the models I've seen, at $7 to $9 gas prices. Substantial revenues, 3, 4, 5 times what we're talking about in this tax. I have not seen modeling on what it's worth to Exxon to delay, and I think it would be difficult to do. We can sit back and though say it's hard to measure, we can recognize it's substantial. One of the things in being involved in this over the last 8 to 10 years, control is more important than short-term profit. I mean, to a big player, control is the most important thing. Profits flow from control, and you're better off to seek those than just short-term profits. No, Representative Gruenberg, I don't know anyone who's modeled the exact number of the advantage to Exxon in postponing this, but we can estimate.
On this, the tax would only apply to the resource, and it ends when the resource starts flowing through the pipeline. Is that
That's right.
That's what the deal is. And it would only apply to Prudhoe Bay and the Point Thompson fields?
Essentially.
Mm-hmm. And so say you have a situation where one of the owners of that gas has entered into an agreement with the state to develop the gas and build a pipeline, and two of the other owners have not, and so there's a stalemate. So one what would get going if it had its own druthers but can't because of the other two. Why should they be subjected to a tax when they've entered into a contract with good faith, want to develop the gas but can't because of the others?
Good questions all. Mr. Chairman, we address that sort of differential impact on the major leaseholders through when the credit starts. After a lot of discussions with a lot of people who are much more knowledgeable on oil and gas leasing than I am, it became clear that you wanted the tax to end only on something that was irrefutable. That is, you didn't want to have a lot of litigation about when this incentive ended. And so the more identifiable, absolutely clearly, it could be, the better. That's why we made it a pipeline pushing 2 BCF a day of gas. Route neutral, ownership neutral. I don't care how, you know, what route, Canadian all Alaska. I care personally, but the bill doesn't. And what ownership structure? Independent, producer owned, Alaska owned, just as long as the gas is flowing. The credit starts, that is, you start to receive a credit from the time that you do what we need you to do, which is either sell the gas or agree to ship it in an open season. And that language is yeah.
Well, let me ask you another question. Why, when you have
Mr. Cameron, could you answer the question?
Yeah, it's on page 5, and it was getting around to it. I apologize for being.
Just answer it. Let him answer.
Oh, sure. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, that was all preface to the answer, which is on page 5. If a particular leaseholder does what we'd like him to do, that is, makes an irrevocable agreement to sell or a binding transportation agreement. That's what you need to do if you have the lease of gas. Sell it to somebody who will ship it, or agree to ship it yourself. Then their credit starts. You only receive a credit from the time that you do those actions, and the tax itself ends when the pipeline is built. So in that situation, the leaseholder that has done what we'd like starts to receive the credit from that day, and the other players do not.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Representative Seaton.
So just to clarify then, let's say if we had three owners of a field, and one of them came with a commitment to sell the gas, and the other two did not. The tax is accruing on all of the gas, but is not part of the credit until they make this binding agreement to either sell or ship. And therefore, if the other two do not make that binding agreement, their tax is there, but no credit would be applied to that until such date as they agree to sell or ship.
Exactly right.
Okay, correct. Thank you.
But
just follow up on that.
Representative Roper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then trying to understand the mechanism, then the firm that's entered into an agreement, they would not receive credit if they'd agreed to ship and so forth. Well, if they agree to ship, there's got to be a pipeline. If they have an open season, you have to have a project, don't you?
Well, a pipeline and a project, you need a project proposal on open shipment, or they could agree to sell. So shipping on a proposal that is there, a live proposal that's going, or agreeing to sell your
agreement
gas.
To sell a gas. Would ConocoPhillips, assuming they finalize that transaction, would that apply? Would that be a example of what you're driving at here?
Well, and that gets into some of the difficulties with the negotiation that Governor Murkowski is now negotiating. It depends on what he concludes. If he concludes an option agreement that Conoco could take these fiscal terms whenever they wanted to, it would not apply here. And I don't believe it would be it wouldn't be a project. It would be a fiscal terms they could take or leave. if what comes out of the governor's office and ConocoPhillips' office is an agreement to ship under these terms, a project definition that is that specific, then yes, it would. It's exactly, this identifies one of the great risks of the entire process, that we will get an agreement on fiscal terms but not an agreement on a project. This needs to start the credit, a real agreement to ship, either by selling or by shipping.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I understand it, notwithstanding that, let's say one company's desire to enter into an agreement and ship their gas, if the particular terms of that agreement are not acceptable to, I'm not sure who, at least under the terms of the statute you have before us, they would not receive credit or they would have to pay the tax, notwithstanding their intention to try to cooperate with the state. Is that correct?
Chairman Wyrock, Representative Roberg, it depends on what they agree to. If they agree to, we can take these fiscal terms and we can build this line anytime we please,
but that's not... What if there's not a line? I mean, what if there is not a project, but they're still willing to enter into it because they can't afford to do it on their own? They get slapped with a tax, even though they don't have the ability to do their own project.
The incentive will remain there until the pipeline is built, and those that act,
or is the incentive the fact that they're paying a tax? What you're calling the incentive?
I'm not sure you let him answer that last.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Roberg and I have known each other and debated for a long time. The way we wrote this, and the way I still believe we need to approach this project, is you don't let up the pressure until the line is done. If you have any other benchmark, you're falling short of what we actually require. So the incentive will remain until the gas is flowing. Those that act in the way that we would like them to, those that move towards a project, not just a fiscal regime, but a project, will get a credit for that and get all that money back. Those that we have to drag to the table will not get that credit.
So if you have a willing party to enter into an agreement, he's still going to have the incentive in paying a tax, whether he wants to or not. Is that right?
They're going to put that earnest money down and get it back, and those that never did aren't going to get it back.
No, but they're going to be paying some interest on the way to the horizon here.
They'll pay some interest on the way to the project.
So was Representative Seaton's question then related to whether they should get that money back with some interest if they've developed the gas? Is that what your question was earlier?
My question was that I don't think that the bill as it is structured right now lays out in firm enough detail the sponsor's initiative or a sponsor's statement that it doesn't accrue interest. And if we don't want it to accrue interest and them get back the interest, I think we need to state that, because otherwise it's going to be a subject of litigation is whether the interest accrues and gets paid back in the credit or not. So I want it to be specific that way. And I guess what I wanted to follow up on was, if one of the parties has an agreement to sell, such as they are saying, okay, if another line, a bullet line or a line to Valdez or some other line comes in, we will sell. That's the agreement that would start the credit.
That's right.
Is that correct?
That's right.
And so it doesn't have to be that we have to build a pipeline to Chicago. We have to say, you know, they have the other option of saying, well, either build a pipeline to Chicago or we agree to sell the gas in place at reasonable fiscal terms, whatever those are. Am I understanding that correctly?
That's right. And that's important, through the chair, Representative Seaton. It's long been thought, and I believe, that first agreement to sell is what clicks this project over, that we've never been able to break the monolith, and that the reason you wanted as much pressure as possible, the reserves tax itself, and this idea is I don't even get the credit till I make this agreement to sell or ship. It's once that happens, all those competitive pressures that Representative Gruenberg were talking about come to bear the other way. That is, it's one thing for Exxon to keep it, to keep our gas in reserve, put Conoco in an awkward situation. If Conoco can agree to sell to us, if they can make that agreement, and there starts to be a viable project, maybe smaller than we'd like, with Exxon not participating, that's a whole new, that's a whole new competitive structure. They may not want it to happen, but they certainly don't want it to happen without them. And so I wanted to put as much pressure as I could to get that first big agreement to sell. And a tax that stays on, but you aren't going to be relieved of it in the credit until you agree, is the mechanism that we came up with.
And follow-up? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is it practically or legally possible for one or two of the owners of a field to sell their gas without the all of the field owners agreeing to produce that gas? I mean, I understand where philosophically you are, where we want agreement for sale, but I want to know the practical aspect and the legal aspect. Can let's say they're equal third owners, can one of those third owners say we are going to sell and produce again, and the other two that don't get in that agreement, can gas still be produced?
Right. Another excellent question. My understanding of it is legally possible and very practically difficult, that the relationships on in the different fields, the different agreements, as well as the other ways that they cooperate in this state on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System and others, make it practically difficult to separate themselves. And it's part of the problem in this negotiation. You're not just negotiating, as you'd think, with three different companies, but with three different companies who have such an interaction of interests that it makes it very difficult for one to pull. But I do believe it's legally possible. It's just one of the practical problems in this negotiation.
Did you have a question? I'm sorry.
Yes, I did.
Go ahead, Representative.
Oh, sure, a couple.
did you have a question?
Through the chair, Representative Croft, Representative Seaton asked about the potential of a bullet line. Would that satisfy the provisions? It appears to me that it would not, because you have a minimum delivery capacity of 2 billion cubic feet a day. Whereas most of the discussions of bullet lines are the 300,000, 400,000, 500,000, or half a B, or less. So a bullet line from the North Slope to Cook Inlet would not qualify, and that gas would still be subject to the penalty of your tax. Is that correct?
Through the chair.
Even so, it was being potentially being produced and shipped.
Through the chair, Representative Rookberg. Maybe I use bigger bullets than you do. We tried to set it to a low project level. That is, would encompass the All-Alaska route or the Canadian route. And what I would like to see in terms of gas sufficient for our own needs and keeping the Kenai going with what it has. It is, you're right, a 2 billion, 2 BCF a day project. And those that you're talking about of three or four, which I don't believe pencil out. I've heard one getting close and one and a half penciling out. We tried to set it at the level of a project that was viable but would encompass any, you know, we've heard two, two and a half, three, three and a half. But you are right that it would not do those very small bullet lines of 300 or 400 MCF a day.
And thank you, which I find a little bit disturbing. And we may find ourselves somewhere down the line 10 years from now with that as the alternative. We miss opportunity windows or the other major projects don't come together. Well, there's such a demand and need for the fuel in the rest of the state that we have to bite the bullet and produce a bullet line. So, but then we just have to repeal your law, I guess.
The legislature and the people can decide what they want to do. I would say that if Exxon and British Petroleum prevail and we are unsuccessful in getting a gas line, and all we're left with is the a very small 300, 400 million cubic feet a day bullet line, that we never got the export potential, we never got the revenues, that you should keep this on the books and continue the pressure so that eventually we could get them to sell that gas, which we own. But you are right that it would not qualify as the condition I wanted on this. Alaskans and I want a gas pipeline that has an export potential, that has revenues for the state. So if we can't get that, we should keep this in place, in my opinion.
Would you, just in terms of managing time, could you follow up with that, then Representative Gruenberg, then I had a question, then I wanted to get the Department of Revenue folks and PERS and TERS folks up here just to ask them.
Yeah, sorry about how long.
Come back with some information for next time, Representative Roper.
Very quickly, just for the record, Representative Croft, what in the scenario where everything goes well, and there's an agreement this session, if you will, and the legislature approves it and the project starts moving forward, what is the circumstance under your statute? If it's still adopted by the legislature and or by initiative, it would still be in place next January 07, and despite the fact that there's an agreement and movement forward, the tax would still go into effect. Is that correct?
Absolutely, and it should. Through the chair, Representative Rookberg, maybe I was thinking earnest money because looking at a former real estate agent, but yeah.
Curb it inactive.
All right. I hope we sign the agreement tomorrow that I have heard was 2 weeks away for 2 years now. And that it has binding commitments to ship and that it gets this gas line moving. In that case, you should keep this going so that we have that earnest money. And if they're serious about it, if it's a serious agreement, if it seriously gets us the gas line that we seriously want, then they'll get that money back without interest, but they'll get it back. But we have a system where every year a delay will cost you, and you know it.
Okay.
It's liquidated damages or earnest money.
I had written down here liquidated damages. I had a question on that. But Representative Gruenberg, and then we're going to have to you're going to have to come back.
Okay.
Sometimes people, companies, governments who own pipelines that have the capacity to ship turn them off. Is there anything in here that reinstates the tax if that occurs?
No. Once that investment is made, I would think that they would have to recoup it, and also their commitments that the shippers make to whatever entity owns the pipe, the physical pipe, to ship. I guess let me think about that some more.
Yeah, I don't need an answer now, but I think on something like this, you're going to be up against the best minds in the world,
right,
who will do anything they can to get out of this tax. That is at least a possibility that you might consider.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions?
No, I apologize for taking so long. It's an interesting subject.
I just wondered, isn't this like a liquidated damages? Like if you don't develop the pipeline, you're paying a fee or fine every day. You're not. And isn't it going to essentially a disincentive to hold leases and gas to chase leaseholders away? I mean, why pay a tax on an uncertain future?
It's an incentive to build the gas pipeline. I understand what you're saying. It has no effect on future exploration. And if the companies decide that they want to turn over the leases, there are hundreds of companies that would take over those. I mean, those are going concerns. They were contracts we signed a long time ago where these companies agreed to develop. And I think they have the contractual duty to do so. They don't. They have no right to come now. And essentially what they're saying is we'll only do this if they agreed to do it. They should do it. We can't nationalize in this country, and for good reason. What we can do is insist on our contractual rights, and I hope we do, and we can use our taxing power. That's what places with constitutions do.
All right. You're going to have to come back next week, a week from today. Is there anyone else here to testify on House Bill 223? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And we're going to close public participation on House Bill 223 to the sponsor. We also, this coming Friday, we're going to take up the two bills dealing with the unfunded liability of the PERS and TERS system And at that time, we're going to have representatives from Division of Retirement and Benefits and Department of Revenue. And is there anyone here who wanted to testify on the PERS and TERS issue? We're going to then focus on those bills and see if we can't use those bills as a focus to try and address the unfunded liability. We're going to have representatives from ARM here, the Alaska Retirement Management Board, Department of Revenue and Retirement Benefits. I hope the committee will have questions for them on information they want so that we can get that information to the committee by next week and hopefully take action on these bills and get them to State Affairs and then up to Finance. So if there's no other questions from the committee, any other witness the committee would like to have before the committee next this coming Friday at all that I can invite? All right, we're adjourned.